for conscription, and it's C for Capitol Hill. Well, it's C for conscription, and it's C for Capitol Hill. And it's C for the Congress that passed that goddamn bill. The utterly... I'd rather be at home, even sleeping in a holler log. I'd rather be here at home, even sleeping in a holler log, than go to the army, be treated like a dirty dog. Diddly.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org. Today's program includes From Media Matters with Bob McChesney from June 13, 2010. Stephen Kinzer and Bob discuss Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Steve Kinzer is an award-winning foreign correspondent who has covered more than 50 countries on five continents. His articles and books have led the Washington Post to place him among the best in popular foreign policy. This is About 50 Minutes. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews the other Scott Horton on September 30th, 2010. The other Scott Horton is an international human rights lawyer, professor, and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he discusses the huge growth in the Department of Justice since its inception and its current questionable role as a legal defender of government crimes. And he also discusses the Department of Justice's double standard. For domestic propaganda purposes, the government can talk about hit lists for U.S. citizens, but when the practice is challenged in court, the topic becomes a state secret. The other Scott Horton is also a member of the board of National Institute of Military Justice. He's on the Andrei Sakharov Foundation and the Eurasia Group and the American branch of the International Law Association. This is About 19 Minutes. And then after that, Source Code talks with Hunter Lovins about natural capitalism. This is About 5 minutes.
You know, Stephen Kinzer, when I had you on the air for your last book a few years ago, one of the comments you made that was very striking to me was that the United States sort of operates in its foreign policy with the sort of conviction that a truly democratic society would only elect governments that supported U.S. policies in their region, that they go hand in hand, that a true democracy would never elect governments that were seen as anti-U.S. in their policies. And which sort of leads to the obvious point, then, how committed democracy is the United States if it's conditional upon getting the results you like, governments you like. And I thought of that as I threw out this book and throughout your comments just now, because it seems that there are democratically elected governments in the region, whether it's in the Palestinian Authority or Iran, despite whatever questions there are about the most recent election. But no matter, you know, that they're democratically elected is irrelevant if the governments are seen as hostile to U.S. interests. So the U.S. is historically and through to the present day much more comfortable with regimes that are pro-U.S., even if they're not especially democratic, it seems like.
That's absolutely true. We have different standards to judge countries that are our friends than we use for countries that aren't our friends. But our advocacy of democracy, even flawed as it is what has inspired many people around the world, including Iranians. I think that's the reason that they love America. They want to have what we have, some semblance of democracy and prosperity. Now, the United States has been very reluctant to support democracy in the Middle East, particularly in the Arab world. The Arab world is the only part of the world that has been bypassed by this democratic train that's been running the last 20 years around the world. Who would have ever thought we would one day see democratic Brazil, democratic South Korea, democratic Liberia, democratic Poland? But this process has not happened in the Middle East. And part of the reason is that the U.S. is afraid that if there is democracy in Arab countries, we're going to wind up with some kind of an Islamist alternative. I think that fear is probably true. If there's a free election in some of those countries, you're going to have a more Islamic government and one that will be less instinctively friendly to the United States than you have now. But in the long run, I see that as positive because in the first place, these movements are going to come to power sooner or later anyway. And the sooner they do, the less radical they will be. And besides that, these countries, like America and European countries, have to go through phases where they test out different kinds of government and figure out, you know, that kind of government doesn't work. We don't want that anymore. We want to try something else. As long as they don't have the chance to choose which kind of government they want, they become more radical and they decompose as societies. And that's what's happened to our partners in the Arab world.
We're going to go back to the phone lines in a second to take some more callers. So the number here again is 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. But I just wanted to touch on one other point before we go back to the phone lines, Steve Kinzer, which is after the Israeli attack on the flotilla a couple weeks ago, primarily Turkish flotilla, to bring aid to Gaza. I listened to a lot of the debate over it on U.S. news media, and what was striking to me was even in media that were among commentators who, by U.S. political standards, would be considered critical of Israel and somewhat supportive of the Palestinians, even in those debates, not to mention the other debates, it's always framed in what's good for Israel, and this is what the best policy for Israel, and the needs of Israel are, of course, what matters. And it struck me just sitting there thinking, if I were a Palestinian listening to this, or an Arab or a Muslim or anyone who just wasn't, you know, in the world, you'd think that like one Israeli life equals 10,000 Palestinian lives in value in U.S. policymakers' minds.
Well, there's certainly reason to believe that when you hear some of the public discourse. The fact is that there can't be a long-term solution that's good for Israel, but that's not good for the Palestinians, because that's not going to be a solution. It's the same situation that we see between the U.S. and Iran. There's not going to be one winner that can emerge from this diplomatic confrontation or whatever kind of confrontation it becomes. Any negotiation between the U.S. and Iran should be like what real negotiations should be like, if they ever happen, between Israel and the Palestinians, which is not an adversarial negotiation, but an understanding that a rising tide will lift all ships, and that stability in this region is good for everybody. We have been caught up in this conflict paradigm in the Middle East for so long that we've lost sight of the fact that stability in the region is actually going to produce benefits for everybody. Israel is not going to be able to protect itself and defend itself and assure its survival indefinitely only through military means. As time passes and demographics change that part of the world, Israel is going to be smaller and smaller. The people that are on the other side of that divide are going to be more and more. And if Israel is surrounded for the indefinite future by millions or tens of millions of people who hate Israel, that is a bigger threat to Israel than anything that can be posed as a military threat.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Steven Kinzer, the author of the new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. He's also the author of other books, including Overthrow, formerly an award-winning foreign correspondent for The New York Times, who's been writing from all over the world, including Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, Europe. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go first to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Just to start with a point of fact, the flotilla was quite international. There was the one Turkish group, which was an Islamist group that has ties to some of the government in Turkey, is my understanding, and correct that if that's wrong. But it was quite internationalist. There were people from all over the world represented. The one ship that was hit the most viciously was the one that carried the concrete and steel for reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the attack, and even from the isolation before that. So I just wanted to clarify that, if I could.
Sure. But,
the point that I wanted to make, and I don't think one, I think one should say something about the anniversary of the election and not put it aside, because I don't think free and fair elections are common anywhere in the world at this point. The U.S. has a spotty record on its own, and we don't need to waste time commenting on. But it seems to me that the representation that I've been hearing through the media is that is just taking the line, which was that this was a stolen election. And I think there's good evidence that was contemporaneous at the time that there were thieving of votes and there were manipulated areas. But it seems to me that overall, the poll cited by Mark Weisbrot, for instance, immediately prior to the election showed that there was going to be a fairly handy victory by the hardliners in Ahmadinejad. So I think that that shouldn't be dismissed. I know it's heretical, but it's an important point, it seems to me. And when one sees that, one says, well, why is that the case? And I think that there's so much not commented on. I bring it up every opportunity I have, which is that the war against Iran through proxies was full apace. It was signed on by the Democrats perhaps some few months before the midterm election and paid forward with $300-400 million worth of covert aid, which aided the Baluchis, the Jandala, the PJAC, the Kurdish groups that were fighting the Iranians. We don't like the PKK, but we like the PJAC. I'm going on and on because I think this is fundamental to the situation. I see that the Bush policy of confrontation was part of what, you know, solidified the hardliners in Iran, and it's terribly counterproductive. And I don't see any kind of dramatic change from that at all. And that I have much more, but I'll leave it at that. And thank you for the show.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen Kinzer. Iran's elections and its recent U.S. policies. Your comments.
First of all, I don't think anybody really knows exactly what happened in the Iranian election. I've never written that the election was all wrong or all right. It's confused. There was a lot of evidence of manipulation. But the United States does not normally react in such an explosive way when there's falsification of elections. Actually, one of our most important partners in the world, President Karzai in Afghanistan, has taken power after an election which was universally described as fraudulent, and the United States' attitude was, well, that was too bad. We wish that hadn't happened. But anyway, that's over now, so let's see what we can do given the situation we have. We're not doing that with Iran. One of the things that I think sometimes people miss in America is that although the repression with which the Iranian regime suppressed those post-election protests last year was quite shocking, to me, the bigger story was the fact of the protests themselves. You would never see hundreds of thousands or millions of people pouring onto the streets after a contested election in, say, Egypt.
Or the United States.
Everybody expects the election to be stolen in Egypt. Nor would they protest after national elections in Saudi Arabia, because there are no national elections in Saudi Arabia. So to me, what that confrontation showed was not just the repression of the regime, but the strong, vibrant democracy in that society. People in Iran are very used to democracy. They're very used to demanding their rights. This is nothing like a dictatorship, let's say, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which I also visited. That was a real one-man totalitarian state. Iran is very different. It's very vibrant. It's bubbling. It's alive. It is certainly not the state that we read about through the demonizing eyes of some of our reporters and politicians.
As for the Obama administration compared to the George W. Bush administration, in your view, have you discerned a difference in policy?
There's been a rhetorical change, but in substance, certainly if you take Iran as an example, there hasn't really been any change. During the Bush administration, at least during the last couple of years, our line to Iran was, you must negotiate away your nuclear program, and we will be willing to negotiate it away with you. And the Iranian attitude was, well, we're willing to negotiate, but we have other things we'd like to talk about, not just the one thing that you care about. I still believe that if we make a serious offer to Iran of negotiations in which there will be an open agenda, and both sides will be able to bring whatever they want to the table, that could be the beginnings of the way toward a breakthrough. But with the change of administration, we have not changed this policy. We are still following the policy of sanctions, confrontation, and insisting that Iran give up essentially the highest card in its diplomatic hand even before it's allowed to sit down at the game. This is not realistic.
You know, this is going to sound heretical, what I'm about to say, I guess, but, you know, I imagine if you're Iran and you see massive numbers of U.S. troops in the country to your immediate east and your immediate west, and you have all these politicians saying you want to overthrow the government and bomb the crap out of it, I would think it's not an I think the Rush Limbaughs of Iran say, hey, we ought to get a nuclear weapon.
And certainly, if the U.S. were ever to attack Iran in order to prevent it from getting nuclear weapons, that would then be the final proof that Iran absolutely needs a nuclear weapon. If you think you can bomb the knowledge out of the minds of Iran's nuclear scientists, that would be maybe a successful attack. But I don't know any way to do that. There are 5,000 nuclear scientists in Iran. And I'll tell you, if you're afraid now that they're going to pass their knowledge on to terrorists or other bad people, just bomb their houses and kill their children and then see how they feel.
Our guest, Steve Kinzer, author of the brand new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently, and I thank them for their patience. Let's start with line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Stephen Kinzer. Chicago, are you there?
Yes, I'm reminded of the quote you gave about President Truman before, the only thing new in the world is history that we haven't known. Similarly, Billy Graham said that he only wished he could have talked to President Bush about the facts of life of regarding the Sunni, Shiite, and the Kurdish and others before they decided to embark on this thing. But apparently the soldiers of reasoning that were in place that would influence the determination to go ahead on the adventure and tragedy that we're in, is based upon foreign policies that was built up a long time ago. I'm reminded of George Kennan, the American ambassador, years ago said that we have a policy that states we no longer should be concerned about the so-called normal things of human rights and other good relationships, but maintaining our standards of living and our own interests and so on. And the whole Carter administration then went on to say anything that is necessary to maintain our interests, which is considered, anything against our interests would be considered an assault on our vital needs and so forth. So we have all these other things in place, and of course, recently the Senator, Secretary of State Baker said we have a foreign policy that we will go to war to maintain our access to oil. So the whole world has gotten in on this matter of resources and the search and a challenge to get more and more, and we're in this bind right now because we're, so I can go on and on, but the part about history being learned and who influences our choices and history is so important. Apparently the wise men have the wisdom, but others have the influence. They have the foot in the door.
I can tell what side of the divide we're on.
Thank you very much, caller, for your comment. You know, let me ask you one other thing, Stephen Kinzer, about Israel that I thought was interesting in your book, and I'll preface it by reminding you of probably something you recall, or you may not, I don't know, from the 2000 presidential debates on foreign policy between Al Gore and George W. Bush. One of their three presidential debates focused on foreign policy, and the issue of the Middle East came up. And then Vice President Gore said, the role of the United States is to be the arbiter of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis and between the Israelis and the Arab nations in the Middle East. And then I think in the same sentence, he went on to say, but of course, we will always support Israel no matter what. And I thought there was an incredibly ironic sentence, but the irony seemed to be lost. But what was striking in your book was reading the amount of aid the United States gives to Israel, which, you know, I'd heard figures before, but I forget the exact figures you gave, but I think it's really jaw-dropping.
It's interesting. When you look back over the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship, it's generally thought of as being based mainly on shared values and principles and history. But as I point out in that book, actually Israel, along with Saudi Arabia, provided some very important covert clandestine services to the U.S. all during the Cold War. People weren't really aware of this. I certainly wasn't. But Israel was the subcontractor for the U.S. whenever we wanted to support, say, the Contras in Nicaragua or the military dictatorship in Guatemala or the apartheid regime in South Africa, and we weren't allowed to do that because of law. Presidents would then call Israel or call Saudi Arabia and say, can you provide us with this cash? If you do, we'll give you some quid pro quo somewhere else. The one comment I wanted to make about the caller's observations has to do with interests. All countries act on behalf of their own interests, which is fine. The Americans, however, have this kind of childlike need to pretend this isn't true. We like to pretend that only other selfish countries basely act on behalf of their own interests. But America not only would not sink so low as ever to defend our interests, but we sacrifice ourselves and our interests in order to help other oppressed people. In fact, what we should do is grow up, realize that we act on behalf of our interests, realize that this is fine, but with one caveat, and that is think clearly about what really is in our interest over the long run, and don't take steps that make you feel good emotionally for a little while, but in the long run wind up undermining your own security. That's the problem we've had too often in the world.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. Our guest is Stephen Kinzer, author of the brand new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, just published by Times Book. Kinzer, of course, is the longtime award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times and author of many other books, including Overthrow. So now let's go back to line two. Champagne, you're on the air with Stephen Kinzer. Yeah, line two, are you there?
Yes. McChesney actually anticipated my question. How much foreign aid do we, in fact, give to Israel every year? Yes. And what are the justifications for it?
Well, if you go through my book, you'll see how the aid has risen over the years, well into the hundreds of millions per year and beyond. As for why we give it, I think the main reason is inertia. The reason we're giving Israel so much aid this year is because we gave it so much last year.
I'm sorry about that. We seem to have a mix-up with our... I think we'll have to hang up that caller. There's some issue there.
Okay.
Stephen, go ahead.
So because of this inertia, we tend to be assuming that every policy we followed last year still makes sense for next year. This is a big problem in our foreign policy making. We never try to start from scratch. We're always caught in this very narrow spectrum of acceptable options, and essentially they're the options that we've been using all along up to now. But if you look at the Middle East, you see that the place is a big mess, and therefore policies need to be changed. And looking at what is going to be good for the United States in the long run, we see that the biggest thing we need in the Middle East is stability. And we need to be following policies that produce that result, even if they go against what some people in Israel say is their government's view of what is actually going to produce stability.
I mean, if I can sum up what I think you're saying, and certainly what I read in the book, is that we're at a moment now in this post-Cold War era in which the U.S. connection to Israel is changing, and that it's actually the U.S. has more incentive now to pressure Israel to make a deal, or pressure those elements of Israeli society which have inordinate power that they need to make a deal.
I think you're right. There are some conflicts in the world, they call them frozen conflicts, like Cyprus and Nagorno-Karabakh. We'd like to get those solved, but if they don't get solved, no big tragedy is going to happen. But the Middle East is not like that. The Middle East crisis is really intensifying. It's getting worse and worse, and the anger and resentment that is spreading in the Middle East and that festers in so many parts of that region poses long-term threats to the West and to us. Meanwhile, the centrifuges are spinning in the nuclear program in Iran. This crisis is getting worse and worse. It is no longer an option for us just to sit by and say, let's let things unfold. We need to focus on this as a challenge and a real priority.
You know, this week or in the last week or so, this Helen Thomas flap took place. I'm sure you're familiar with it if you've been paying, watching our news media. It's gotten more attention than most coverage of Middle East issues has gotten, at least in the popular news media. And I was struck because as that occurred, I was reading the section of your book, Stephen Kinzer, where I think it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt was talking with the King Saud.
Yes.
Where King Saud said this idea of turning Palestine over to the Jews was irrational, or not, was unfair, because the Palestinians weren't responsible for European anti-Semitism. They should get it. And he was sympathetic to the Jews, said, but they should get a chunk of Germany. That's the country that did them in.
Yeah, he said the world will shake if the Jewish state is created in Palestine, and he certainly was borne out in that. Actually, the decision of President Truman to support the creation of Israel, as I point out in my book, was the only big foreign policy decision that he took over the objection of all three of his principal foreign policy advisors. Mm-hmm. And the story of why he did that and this friend that he had who persuaded him and started weeping in the Oval Office is fascinating. So,
yeah, and it's in the book, example. I should add. People, you write about that in the book, and I was unaware of that story until I read your book.
Yeah, I like to think that a lot of people who read my book will come away with that reaction to at least some piece of it. I always want everyone who reads my book to close it thinking that there was at least one story in there that was really interesting that I never knew before.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.